Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 241, episode 4 of Der Daily Zeitgeist, a production of iHeartRadio. This is a podcast where we take a deep dive into America's shared consciousness. It's Thursday, June 16th, 2022. What do we got, Miles? It's a couple
National
days before
Fudge Day.
National Fudge Day.
You a fudge fan?
That's what I was about to say. It's a couple days before National Fudge Day. I get jumpy around National Fudge Day. I'm always, sometimes I miss it, but glad it's finally here, National Fudge Day.
Do you like fudge?
Yeah. I don't dislike fudge, you know. I grew up going to a boardwalk on the Jersey Shore on a summerly basis, and that was always the free samples of fudge, never disappointed, as opposed to the saltwater taffy, which exclusively disappointed.
Yeah.
So it's... Yeah. Fudge delivers, I feel like.
It's like, aren't some like so, I feel like so packed with sugar, like one bite, right? Which is like one bite and you will like start hallucinating from the sugar. It's wild because I remember vividly once eating a piece of fudge so fast and like my grandmother being disturbed.
Yeah.
Like being like, how the fuck did you just eat all that? And I'm like, I'm a child who loves sugar and this might be the best thing I've ever had.
Fudge all over your lips and mouth. Yeah. Well, anyways, my name is Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. keeping track of all the Mountain Dew flavors and the January 6th hearings. Call me Count Dooku.
Oh.
That is courtesy of Chris Barrera. And I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray!
All the other kids with gazumped up scoops better run your dirt before I air it. All the other kids with gazumped up scoops better run before my tabloid swears it. Shout out to Scouty Magoo. Reference to that really awesome, was it the Sydney Morning Herald going after Rebel
Sydney
Wilson?
Morning Herald.
We will drag you out if you don't say
why
something.
Why they were pissed that somebody outed themselves before they could.
What a fucking take.
Thus gazumping their story. Well, Miles, we are thrilled to be joined in our third seat by the hosts of the American Prestige podcast, which is a foreign policy podcast about the United States and all the friends it made along the way. A really great listen. I suggest everybody go check it out. They are Daniel Bessner and Derek Davison. What's up?
Hey.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here. Happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Where are you coming to us from?
Los Angeles, California, Echo Park.
Okay.
Hey, all right.
Northern Virginia. I'm the only person living here who isn't a defense contractor.
All right, Nova. Oh, wow.
That we know of. Right. My understanding is you wouldn't be allowed to tell us if you were like in the... Yeah,
Derek's an op, actually. That's a big scoop here today.
We will try not to gazump it, although, you know, the Defense Department might come through.
Yeah.
Had you guys ever heard that phrase, gazump, or that word?
No, I just heard it for the first
time.
Yeah. Jack, is it a thing the kids are saying?
I feel why the fuck have I heard gazump before? I can't be alone in ever hearing.
And I'm a professor, man, and none of my kids have ever accused me of gazumping, or I've never heard each other, you know, accusing each other of gazumping.
Is that bad? I mean, maybe you're not cool enough to be gazumping.
How dare you, Derek?
Yeah. I'm just saying. I mean,
I can gazump.
Miles is young and cool.
You're getting to an age where
there's a very good chance that like people know not to say gazump to us, maybe, but they're like, this guy looks like
it's like regional. I feel like it's like UK English or some shit. You know what I mean? Like that's why we're not hearing, because it's not like a cool word. I'm just like, I just feel
definitely not.
No.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
That's really funny. Cool. Yeah. So, Daniel, you are a professor.
Yeah.
And Derek, you write about foreign policy. You guys know your shit, which
we know our shit.
Is important to establish up top.
Yeah.
There's a slight contrast where we are not experts on the show.
We know about Mountain Dew.
Yes.
We know about Taco Bell. We know about weed. We know about basketball. And we know something is terribly afoot in this country. That's about it.
But I mean, those are all important things to know.
Exactly.
There's nothing
we're on the road to a new level of consciousness, I would say.
By the way, I do want to just kind of put it out there for our listeners. I will be doing a Mountain Dew tasting tomorrow. I will have a spit bucket and I will be doing a Mountain Dew tasting of a couple new flavors. So after the headiness of today's episode, you can look forward to that. I think we got thrashed apple and we got another new flavor.
Oh, no. So they're doing the extreme 90s thing still. They're doing radical blueberry.
Yeah.
Nice. The 90s are alive in the hills
in
of
all
Mountain
of our
Dew.
Hearts.
Right.
All right. Well, we are going to get to know you guys a little bit better in a moment. First, we're going to tell our listeners a couple of the things we're talking about. Just off the rip, I'm going to be like, hey, like, is there any hope for a leftist movement in the U.S.? Hey, you guys know stuff. Is there any hope? Because, yeah, I'm just genuinely curious. It's something that comes up pretty frequently, just the lack of a revolutionary imagination in the U.S. So want to get you guys' thoughts on that. We'll talk about Coachella, Night 3. We got Loudermilk, which is a great name. And he apparently gave some insurrectionists a tour the night before January 6th. And no big deal, nothing to see here. But
yeah, says the cops. And you're like, wait, hold on, what? Okay.
But so we'll talk about that plenty more. But first, we do like to ask our guests, Daniel, Derek, what is something from your search histories?
So I was searching Buchteln, which is an Austrian pastry, because one of my good friends, Megan Day, one of the best writers on the left today, she writes for Jacobin, is in Vienna. So I was looking up things for her to see. She went to Freud's house, but I also thought she needed to get a little sweet in there. And that is an apricot-filled bun called Buchteln. So if anyone ever goes to Vienna, strongly recommend you get it.
What's the bun made of? Describe the bun, the pastry.
It's like a kind of a popover, like a southern popover, but it's filled with fresh apricot jelly. And it was at this famous cafe, I believe called the Cafe Havelka, where like all the Viennese intellectuals used to eat. And it's still around. It's in the center of the city. And it's honestly the best pastry I've ever had in my life. It's truly fantastic.
Okay.
Europeans really do a good pastry.
Yeah, and I believe in France, the name for like small pastries is viennoise, because the Viennese have really good pastries. And also, I would recommend the Zachertort, if you're ever there. Mm. It's also really good stuff.
Okay.
The Spanish empanadilla is Spain. I don't think is very known for their pastries, but man, that shit is really good.
Okay.
Just you put a piece of paper on it, it immediately becomes see-through.
And oh, that's what I like.
That's how you know. And it's filled with things that like don't typically go together in my day-to-day diet, like olives, eggs, tuna, tomatoes, tomato paste, and it just fucking really goes. It's really good.
I like that you said that it passed the Simpsons Dr. Nick test. like when Homer's trying to gain the weight. It's just like, yeah, rub it, and if it goes see-through, it's good.
That's right.
Didn't he put it on a wall, episode. And the wall became transparent?
He's at a Krusty Burger, yeah.
Yeah, and then a bird hits it. Anyway, that, I'll always remember that. It turns things see-through.
Derek, how about you? What's something from your search history? Allow us to pry into your privacy.
Yeah, I Googled the plot of the new Jurassic Park movie. This is something I do when I've, with sequels, when I've like seen one of the movies, like the first movie or whatever, but I have no desire to see the sequel, but I'm still like morbidly curious what the story is. So I just like spoil myself, and then I have no desire to actually go to the movies and see
it. Oh, I have that same morbid curiosity.
And it drew you in just when you thought you were out, Miles.
Just when I thought I was out, Hammond's ghost pulls me back in. Damn, John Hammond. It was so bad.
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah, but...
So I did the right thing then, Googling
spoilers. Well, here's the
spoilers
thing,
and
Derek,
and not
I love a Jurassic Park movie. Like, because the first one's so good, I will suffer every single one in the theater. I have the same, like the same philosophy with Terminator films. Like, I will go to the theater. I don't care. I don't, even if it's so clear that it's bad from the trailer, I'm like, it's still a moment. So I go, but this one has like a Tim Cook analog in it that is so fucking weird. And just the, it touches on like, what if there were dinosaurs? And then we're all back to a contained dinosaur thriller, like every other fucking Jurassic Park movie. And you're like,
like they just stick
they
them in
just
like a park
start out there.
They're in the Dolomites in Italy.
Okay.
Like in the mountains of Italy, there's, I'm like, wait, hold on. Now we're in fucking Italy with dinosaurs. And I'm like, whatever, fine, fuck it.
Is there any cool stuff up top with the like world now run by people be like just fleeing from the dinosaurs?
Yeah, the film opens with
okay.
different news stories about our new world of, you know, cohabitating with dinosaurs and what do we do Man. With them. So like first it'll be like
premise.
Little cutie dinosaurs at a park and like yee wow, and then other ones were like a fucking stegosaurus like blows up a gas truck and you're like yeah maybe not. So it's like that part I was like this is great.
Yeah, wait, is this gonna be good?
Yeah, but you couldn't. So for you, Derek, like you just saw it and you like it enough that you want to know what happened, but not enough to subject yourself
but
to 2 hours
not
and
to
40
go to the
minutes
sequel,
of nonsense.
Yeah, but your I mean your relationship with Jurassic Park sounds like mine with Star Wars. I mean, I've seen every, all whatever, there have been 11 now.
Yeah.
Even though, like, you know, maybe 2 of them were good, I've seen every one anyway.
Right.
And I keep,
yeah,
I
it's
keep
like
doing
weird how
myself.
Things from the 80s or 90s, I'll just pledge these blind allegiances to. And I'm like, I am a guaranteed ticket sold for all of your terrible fucking output.
And I think that's because there's no outlet for politics. So we just pour it into culture. That's
right.
What
yeah.
I think is really going on there. You know, back in the day, people used to find meaning in associations and politics. But since there's really, I think, a lack of mass politics today, and Jack, that might answer your question a little bit, is just we pour all of our meaning into these cultural products that we saw when we were kids and they made us feel good. And
yeah,
we keep on trying to make it, we keep on trying to hit that sort of like heroin dopamine button.
Yeah.
And each time it's a little less, it's a little less.
Yeah. Because right. Yeah, if you look at Jurassic Park as a vein you'd shoot up into, the first one, healthy as shit. That motherfucker was popping out. And by Jurassic World Dominion, you're like, man, maybe there's some shit on the bottoms of my feet. I don't know.
It's mostly because, baby powder.
Yeah.
You're going through the carpet just looking for...
Yeah, anything.
Yeah. Oof. Mashing up little pieces of Flintstone vitamins. I like a good heroin metaphor. I like to just keep it going, you know.
Yeah, you know,
keep running as long as possible. Yeah, that's what. So I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that because I will be proposing my idea to have Rian Johnson lead the leftist revolution, the director of The Last Jedi, because there has been more anger and energy around The Last Jedi than I think maybe any political movement in my lifetime.
Whoever directed RRR too. You know, maybe give them a shot at
Did you watch
party.
It yet?
This shit's fucking three.
It's 3 hours, but it flies by.
I have 45 shit. Minutes left. So
okay.
All that to say, I cannot stop watching it.
Yeah. Have you guys seen RRR? On
no,
Netflix?
But I hear it's amazing.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet either, but I like Danny, I've heard
it's fucking
heard good
wild
things.
In like the best
it's
way.
Pretty wild. What is something you guys think is overrated? Daniel, let's start with you.
The American Empire.
Mm.
Okay. All right. I mean, we're pro-American Empire in this podcast.
Yeah, hold on. What are you trying to say, man?
Whatever, bro.
Well, I think that's one of the, just to get into our little podcast a bit, one of the reasons that we actually started it is because we think there's kind of a fawning coverage in the mainstream media about what the United States does in the world. And ultimately, there's this belief that I as a historian think has been empirically proven incorrect, that the United States' military and economic power is going to be able to make the world a better place. And I think a lot of people really still believe that, and they believe that out of the goodness of their hearts. But I just think, for reasons we could go into, that that's really not the case. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really one of the most overrated things in American politics today.
And do you think people still actually, like, genuinely believe this? This actually, I did like a 20-minute chunk about how weird the, like, I hadn't listened to NPR in a number of years, and then I, like, started listening to NPR, and I was just like so taken by how weird the voice is. And I think that, like, there's like some weird cognitive dissonance like thing happening with neoliberals, and like I think they're like starting to understand like that it's all bad, but they can't. And so like now they have to like be talked to like this, and they have to like have people explain the conflict in Ukraine to them like it's a fun wine picnic that they're planning. And like, I feel like more and more people, it's like creeping in a little bit.
Absolutely, because it's just hard to deny. I do think there's a big generational gap. But even if you look at statistics, I think I might get this wrong, but it's something like 44% of millennials still think the United States should like run the world. That's pretty high still, you know, roughly one in two. And if you go to boomers, it's like way higher. So right. I think the way that I view it, it's more the background assumption, the water people swim in, the air that they breathe.
Yeah.
It's not something that they think about, because I think very smartly, the United States imperial state in the early 70s ended the draft. So if you're like a normal person, you're really not going to encounter the military in any way, shape, or form really in your life. And so it just allows the empire to kind of hum along in the background. So I think there's unquestioned support or unthinking support for what we do in the world.
Another piece of propaganda that I think is very reflective of this is the new Top Gun movie, wherein it's just, they don't even pretend to mention another country. Like, I think it's pretty clearly Iran, but like, they are just like, these are the bad guys. They can't have nuclear weapons. We blow them up. And it's just baked in there.
Yeah.
But it's so like faceless. It's like a target range with just like bad guy pop up, you know?
I think so. And we actually just we did a special episode with Chapo Trap House on our podcast. We did Top Gun 1 on their podcast. We did Top Gun 2.
Okay.
But one of the things that's interesting about that is that that's kind of how Americans view the world, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
It doesn't matter who they are.
Right.
We're just going to fucking do whatever the fuck we want because we're America, goddammit.
Yeah, we're the main character.
Exactly. And so I think like that could be read as a form of critique. I don't think the intention of critique was there. But, you know, from it's postmodernist, the author is dead. So let's just say it's a critique.
Why sure.
Right.
Let's do it. How about you, Derek? What's something you think is overrated?
So I didn't take this as seriously as Danny, and I kept with the movie. I stuck with the movie theme.
Go.
And I saw that like the live action Aladdin was on TV the other night. And I just thought like these live action Disney remakes, I haven't seen one that was better than the like 1990s cartoon.
Right.
And
right.
I just don't get it. I don't get that. I mean, I know they make a ton of money. I get why they get made, but I just don't get why people care to go see them. So I think they're overrated.
And Aladdin, the live action Aladdin, just didn't pull at those heartstrings?
No, I mean, it really didn't. And like, I mean, you know, I remember going to the movies to see the Beauty and the Beast remake, because my daughter was at that time of the age where she was into that kind of thing. And just watching it, and like the whole time I couldn't stop going like, why did this have to be made? Like, what's the point of this? What was the purpose of making this? And in the minds of the people who did it, like, what were they fixing about the original? And I, you know, can't think of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Did they mention a country at all, or is it similar, like, broadly orientalist space?
In Aladdin.
Because in the original,
I don't think they mention a country.
Yeah. It's a mix between Arabia and like Pakistani.
Well, the original got in a ton of trouble. They had to like overdub lines and stuff because it was a little bit
Yeah. Hey, hey, it's barbaric.
Racist.
Yeah.
That's where it's from. The place was called Agrabah in the in the animated version.
Yeah. Mm. And it's like the Taj Mahal, but in Arabia, kind of, if I recall.
Yeah.
Correctly.
It's a real
it's just a mixing of Muslim cultures.
Yeah. Don't worry. We
just over there.
Do you guys, do you guys remember shapes? A few years ago, somebody ran a poll and they asked, like, people if they would bomb a particular country, and they included Agrabah. And like a third of Republicans said they would support bombing the nation of Agrabah.
Yeah.
But make it a democracy. You know, the Sultan is a monarch. You got to turn Agrabah into a democracy.
What is something you guys think is underrated?
Well, so I can go here because I have actually, I think I have a serious one for this. It was, when I was in grad school, I studied Islamic history, and one of my favorite figures in Islamic history is a guy named Ibn Battuta, who was a traveler in the 14th century and traveled farther, if you believe all of his accounts, traveled farther than anybody else has ever traveled, basically, in world history before modern times when you could like hop on a plane. And it was just yesterday was his the anniversary of the beginning of his Hajj, which he started from Morocco, Tangier, and then just kept going after he did the Hajj all the way to China and back. And I don't think enough people know about him. I think he's a very underrated guy for having traveled supposedly 73,000, something like 73,000 miles in his lifetime. Although it's possible he made up parts of his travel log, but we don't know.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about the history of like explorers and like, you know, the people who we lionize as great explorers. And I'm not saying this is the case with him, but like a lot of European explorers, you know, you look at the things they were claiming to have seen and it's like, oh, you guys are just like professional liars.
Right.
And
yeah,
then we met the three-headed people of the Amazon who were 13 feet tall.
What?
And yeah.
Yeah, it's wild, man, but you'll never get there because you're poor.
Anyways,
<so.
laughs> love Marco Polo.
Yeah, I mean, like this guy definitely traveled a lot, but there are some parts of his account, like the China part and a couple of other kind of side trips that some historians think he may have just cribbed from somebody else's description.
Yeah, that's what the traveler's named Ibn, you know? Because I studied Viking history, and there's Ibn Fadlan, who's like
Ibn Fadlan's a big one, sure.
It means son of, right, Derek?
Yes.
Yeah, Ibn is son. It's like Ben in Hebrew.
There it is. But yeah, I just was thinking of him as the guy who's like, yeah, and then I went up the Volga River and met the Vikings. You're like, what the fuck? People were getting
like
out
the Northman.
Also, I'm just going to put it out there, traveler as a profession. Just like, hello, friend, I'm just a fellow traveler. Right. I feel like that's always a nice mysterious thing to say that I've never thought as an option.
It's hard to do now. He was able to like go places and he had training as a lawyer. So he or, a, you know, kind of a judge, like legal training. So he was able to get like notes of good conduct all along the way to say like this guy knows what he's doing. And he could get jobs wherever he went. As a scholar or a judge, but I don't know. Nowadays, people get like GoFundMes or something to like pay for my trip or whatever. But I don't know what the modern equivalent is of that.
Yeah, it's a Kickstarter for your travel blog.
Yeah. Right.
Parachute Sheets pays for your travel, whatever. How about you, Dane?
Derek took mine. No, just kidding. I was going to recommend a book called "The Tragedy of American Diplomacy." It's a really short book on U.S. foreign policy, but I think it really gets sort of at the major trends by a guy with a hell of a name, William Appleman Williams. So I recommend people to check that out.
William Appleman Williams. Hell yeah.
I mean, aside from what's for you, what sort of differentiates it and why do you suggest it?
Because it really shows the economic basis of a lot of U.S. foreign policy, the search for export markets, the search for capital-intensive development aid and things like that. And so it was really influential when it was released in the 1950s. And it's just like a very short, very readable book that explores why the hell the United States does what it does in the world.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. So it tells you how the world actually works.
Yes, how the world. If it was released today, it would be like how the world actually works. One of those like slate pitch titles,
right?
Like,
right.
How to explain through this one cool thing how the United States does everything in the world. Oh, I believe slate pitch. That's probably a dated reference now. That's an elder millennial reference.
Right.
The kids are going to be like, "What the fuck is slate?"
So we'd like to actually make this part of the Freakonomics franchise, if possible, Mr. Williams. It will be Economic Forum Markets, Freakonomics.
Mr. Appleman Williams, please.
Mr. Appleman Williams. Yeah. I mean, the apple in his name could go with the logo of Freakonomics. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. You could do W Apple W.
There you go. All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, criminals and libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Danville was Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in that grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. I was going to say, and we're good. We're good.
All right.
So something we cover a lot on the show is just like the lack of a revolutionary imagination or like an imagination for an alternative for how the U.S. could work without the current form of like hyper-capitalism. And then we also have talked about, I've like kind of posited the theory that like the public is generally just out on the current state of things, like after the like 2008 collapse, and then just the continued persistent like evidence of the whole thing. It's just corruption all the way down, and we're being given like I think logically we should have two options. One would be a leftist alternative or like a socialist alternative, and the other is fascism. And it feels like sometimes fascism is the only one that's like fielding a team in the modern world, which scares me. So I don't know, you guys cover all sorts of very interesting stuff. You're very learned, but you've covered the history of leftist revolutionaries and, you know, countries that are more socialist than the U.S. So I just wanted to like kind of put that subject out there to you. Sure. Guys. Yeah,
sure. Well, I have a lot of thoughts about this. It's kind of what I focus on in my academic work. So I think there's a lot of things you got to focus on. One, things that we've been talking about in the general discourse, of course, like the Senate and the counter-majoritarian institutions of the United States, like the Supreme Court, are kind of baked into the cake from the beginning. Because so, there's a skepticism of democracy and the mess just baked into the cake of the American state. And I think over the course of the 20th century, what has happened, particularly after World War II, is that the actually existing American state that has been developed, particularly when we're talking about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. economic policy, has been specifically designed in a way to ensure that both ordinary people, what you just called the public, but also Congress, doesn't really have that much of an effect on foreign policy and economic policy. And this was actually, this is the period I studied, this was actually a conscious decision made by American elites, because when they were looking at the 1930s, they saw the rise of fascism in Europe, they saw the rise of, you know, imperialism in Japan. They saw in response to the Great Depression a lot of labor strikes at home, and they became very skeptical of mass politics. Because it's really in the 1920s when you have the first type of real mass politics, like the radio and all of those sorts of things, allow people to form large collectivities. So over the course of the 20s and 30s, they become very skeptical of this. And so from the 1940s onward, they create a state in which ordinary people don't really have that much say. And I think that's the experience that we're living in today. It's just evolved into other directions. And so I wrote actually a piece for Derek's Substack Foreign Exchanges called The End of Mass Politics, because I think one of the reasons that everyone feels like they're going crazy today is that all we do is talk about politics, but there's very little actual road to make political transformations. I said at the beginning of the show, this is why people are really interested in culture, but it's also why people are really interested in fighting online, because there's no real way to actually channel your political energies into something meaningful. So if we're thinking about a leftist revolution or a change in actual like fundamental structures of the United States, I think we need to do like an old school 1930s power mapping and see where power lies. And right now, in the literal structure of the American state, power literally lies with several thousand people living in and around Washington, D.C., both in the government, like in places like the State Department and the Defense Department, and then in nominally private institutions like think tanks, which are really just analogs of the government. So I think we need to really reform the structure before we could even start talking about making actual political and policy changes. So I think the lack of revolutionary consciousness and the channeling of a lot of these energies into, you know, ephemeral culture, you know, ephemeral arguing is just really a product of the literal reality that there's very few ways for us to actually shape politics. And I think that is what we need to be focusing on right now, actually making this country a democracy in a real way, actually bringing mass politics back.
Cool. So how do we do that?
Star one is identify the problem. Comment. Seriously. I think there's a lot of magical thinking on the left. I think the way that I put it, and this is a little harsh and I'm being a little bit facetious, but like when we don't have an answer, we say organize, right?
Right.
But when we say organize, right, what does that mean? When people were organizing in previous moments in American history, they were organizing with like the guy or the woman that they spent all day living next to, working next to in a real community. What capital has done over the last 40 years is really reform labor relations so that you have things like the gig economy. You have things like where people are working three jobs that prevent the solidarity upon which actual organization relies. So I think what the first thing to do is really just take a step back and look at how power actually functions and look at how society actually functions. And from there, we could begin to develop actual strategies for how we can reform some of these very, very significant obstacles to any form of left-wing organizing or left-wing transformation. I think the problem also is the fact is that right now the left is really concentrated in basically people who went to college, people who are relatively highly educated. So there's a significant disconnect from the working class base, which is partially a function of this reformulation of labor relations that we really need to attack head on, or there's very little hope, I think, for left-wing transformation.
Mm. Derek, any thoughts?
Well, I would seize on, or I would kind of grab onto something you talked about there, which was the concept of solidarity, which used to mean something. I feel like just like sort of organized, it doesn't mean anything anymore. The only times I, you know, most of the time I hear the word solidarity used is when somebody is scolding the left in the U.S. for not taking some foreign policy catastrophe seriously enough. So there was a lot of this talk with respect to Syria. You see it sometimes with Ukraine now, you know, this sort of like, you're not doing it right. You're not approaching these issues with the right mindset. Well, okay. And then, you know, you sort of say, well, is it that you would like the left to do? And the answer is always something like solidarity without any meaning behind it. Like, we're just supposed to feel solidarity with
feel harder, Derek.
Yeah, feel harder. I mean, that's really what a lot of this is. It's vibes politics. It's not real material politics. It's vibes. You know, I have little hope for a true leftist movement in the U.S. and even less, despite, you know, I know you guys, you know, have talked about Gabriel Boric in Chile and some of the other kind of Latin American leftists that have come into power again and sort of. It's been a little bit of a wave of late. Those movements are, you know, they're great as far as they go. They're sort of optimistic as far as they go. But it's the United States that ultimately, especially in the Western Hemisphere, sets the terms for how far any movement like that is allowed to go before there's
right.
Yeah, some kind of pullback. Change. And right. In the Cold War, you know, that would have been a coup and you know, possibly the murder of whoever was being a pain in the ass leftist. Now it's sanctions. It's, you know, right. Cuba, the Cuba Venezuela model. You know, you can see it even in the leftists who have been elected over the last couple of years, you know, really like sort of self-moderating in a sense. You know, they run with these backgrounds that are of the left, but they run on campaign. They run campaigns where the message is, don't worry, I'm not going to like change that much. I'm not going to nationalize anything. We're just going
right.
to kind of make some reforms around the edges. And that message is meant for domestic political audiences, but it's also meant for the U.S. It's also meant for Washington. Like, don't worry, I'm not going to rock the boat too much. You don't have to treat me like Nicolas Maduro or the Castros. So I, you know, I think as long as the United States maintains the kind of power that it has to affect global politics, and I don't mean like geopolitics, like politics, domestic politics in countries around the world, you know, there's always going to be a cap on how far these things are allowed to go, at least in countries that are dependent on the U.S., whether it's for trade or vulnerable to, you know, depend on the U.S. for military support or are vulnerable to the U.S. in a security sense. There's always going to be this limit on how far they can go.
Are you guys like encouraged by that kind of energy behind unions right now? Like so one thing that like sticks out to me that I hear from like people on the left even is that like the Sanders campaign and like the inability to get Sanders the nomination in 2020 was like that was the last chance, and now like it's kind of hopeless from this point forward. And like it feels like the general, you know, the thing that we try to track on this podcast, the general like zeitgeist, the American shared consciousness, like is moving in the direction like of socialism. Like older people are dying every day and like young people are turning 18 every day, and like their general outlook on the world, not perfect by any means, but definitely more sympathetic, and like there's more energy on that front. And like that does, you know, that seems to be the thing that fuels these sorts of movements is like the students, just because there's like a reputation that like, well, students don't vote in America. It's like, well, probably for very good reasons, like to this point, but like I don't know, it just feels like there are things to be optimistic about within America, at least in terms of like improving the odds and improving the chances that we can like get socialist reform, like in the country. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't have the specifics of like how that is done. And it does seem like, you know, the fact that you like identified the deep state, well, that's something that like is being identified as a problem and like a holder of power, but it's being identified by like the fascists, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think there's always room for optimism and there's always room for hope because that's just the reality. I mean, the empirical reality is that things change over time. I'm a historian. Things change over time. So it's never, I don't view what we're saying as blackpilling necessarily. I just view it as trying to take a realistic, strategic look at the situation in order to change it. I think a couple of things need to be recognized. The era of, you know, great revolutions of the first half of the 20th century and the second half of the 19th century, a lot of that was spurred by literal things like starvation and food. And one of the great developments of the 20th century is the Green Revolution, which allowed us to produce a ton of calories for cheap. So that's a big shift. I think that that's not something to be underestimated. The fact that people aren't hungry, the fact that in fact across the class spectrum you could eat a lot of calories for relatively cheap is actually a huge obstacle in front of revolution. I think that's also true for cheap entertainments. One of my big predictions that I've been making is that in the next 5, 10, 15 years, you're going to see the legalization of a lot of vice, things like sex work, things like drugs, because I think that's going to be a solve on revolutionary political energies. It's not going to be a conscious choice. It's just going to be something that's going to happen. You're going to have vice and you're going to have cheap food. And that those two are really big obstacles in favor of revolution. Now, in terms of younger people, that's generally true. But a lot of the reason that's true is because younger people have time. And one of the things that capitalism does very effectively is that the penalty for not being in the system is like so bad. It's being unhoused. It's not having access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's basically being considered not a human being. And correct me if I'm wrong, Derek, but I think Tennessee just basically made it illegal to be an unhoused person. So I think you're going to see things like that, because when you're actually in the rat race of capital, you have very little time, one, to think about revolution, or two, to enact it. So before, one thing you actually hear throughout history is kind of like, not that the kids are going to save us, but that there's going to be revolutionary energy in younger generations. But oftentimes what happens is as they get a little older, that revolutionary energies are dissipated just by the dictates of the system. I am encouraged by Amazon and Starbucks unionization. I hope that could happen. But I think we just need to wait and see to determine whether that indicates like a return to the 1950s, where you had relatively high levels of unionization in the country. I think it's an open question, but it is something hopeful, and it's something that hopefully we'll be able to build on.
Yeah.
My skepticism is the institutionalization of sort of counter revolutionary impulses is just gets more and more entrenched. You know, I mean, anything from gerrymandering, you know, House districts to the new hurdle in the Senate now that you need. Well, it's not that new anymore, but, you know, that you need 60 votes to do anything. A simple majority isn't enough anymore. The court system increasingly is. You know, has always been counter-revolutionary to some degree, but you're talking about things that are being instantiated now that are going to take a generation or more to be washed out and to have sort of these structures lifted so that there's room for serious change. And I think Danny's right. The idea of the revolution to overthrow these things all in one fell swoop is pretty far gone. You talk about over a longer term, yeah, there, you know, there could be some reasons to be optimistic, but then you start to run into things like, you know, are we going to get another pandemic that's worse than this one? Are we going to start? I know it's going to be decades before the United States really starts to feel the effects of climate change. It's happening already in some other parts of the world. But what happens when that really becomes a problem? You know, right. How does that change politics? And I think it inevitably is going to reduce the scope of people's thinking down to a more local level. And, you know, what am I doing just day to day to survive this, which makes the possibility of like large scale systematic change, you know, it sort of atomizes everybody and makes it harder to conceive of anything like that.
And I think you're going to see a return to liberal federalism. where liberal states, because this is where populations are so concentrated, are going to start defying the federal government. And that'll be very interesting, because for most of the last century, the centralized state was the focus of liberalism. But I think that it's been captured by so many reactionary interests that you'll actually see a return to what might be termed a states' rights liberalism. I'm in California. I don't know where you guys are, but I think you're already seeing the glimmers of that. That'll be very interesting. That'll be something new in our lifetimes.
Right.
Mm. I think, Miles, you were making the point recently that, like, a lot of the revolutionary energy we saw with regards to police and the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of that started really picking up and getting organized and making a, like, gaining national attention around the time that everything shut down. Like during the pandemic, and
right,
like giving people time is so important.
Because we took our foot off the pedal of capitalism, and it wasn't crushing people anymore. And they took a breath and they said, fuck my working conditions. Fuck
the big transformation. I think the big transformation, at least for what it's going to be, remote work. People are going to accept that deal. I think a lot of people are. You let me not have to go to the office. I like work all day, but really I work for 3 or 4 hours and I could live my life. I think that's a deal that's going to be a deal that capital makes with labor. And right. I think that's going to be a big thing. And it's not a surprise that you see unionization in the workplaces where you can't do that, where you can't be a Starbucks remote worker or an Amazon remote worker.
Right. Because, most workers aren't remote.
Exactly. And you do have to recognize the second they could get AI to replace all those workers, they will now. That's coming on the horizon relatively soon. And we need to be planning for that if we're serious. And this is more than just like a subcultural identity, like being a punk. We need to be like ready for that transformation, which is coming very soon.
And the way to be ready for that, I think we can all agree, is just when you see a robot in the wild, you got to kick it over, right? Yeah. You got to kick that thing over.
One of those robot dogs.
Beat a Roomba.
Kaiser now employs the big like hospital conglomerate out here, employs those. You see them rolling around the city all the time. Just kick that shit over. That's probably not what you guys would recommend. But
that is interesting, right? Because like you're saying, capital always has to find a way to kind of be like, fuck it. All right, let's give them that. So it's not full blown like, wait, what the fuck are the bosses doing? We need to fuck them up. Like what then? I think because that's why so many people are interested in like UBI and things like that. It's like, well, if they don't have fucking jobs, we can't just have hungry people out in the streets, because that, like you're saying, those are the little bit of seeds of revolutionary action. And to keep people docile, I'm curious like if that, how that will be looked at, like how they are going to then support a whole other chunk of the population who isn't able to work because of automation, and how that's, you know, how they're going to subdue those people's appetites for something better for themselves.
I mean, I think UBI is a possibility, but it's going to come at the cost of something else, and I don't know what that is, but it'll come at the cost of some other part of the welfare apparatus.
Right.
All right. Well, Derek, I know you have to run. We really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Can you let people, and Daniel, you can stick around for...
Yeah, I can stick around for however long you guys need.
Okay, great.
I got nothing going on, man. My teaching is done.
Nice. Derek, where can people find you, follow you, all that good stuff?
So there's the podcast, American Prestige, which is, pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. But please come check us out. We're on Substack now. That's our home, AmericanPrestigePod.com. And while you're at Substack, you can also check out my newsletter, which is Foreign Exchanges, fx.substack.com. Those are the two places.
And CIA.gov, right?
They can I don't like to talk about that openly.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Great meeting you. Thank you so much for coming on. And we'll be right back.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. Have fun in Davos.
Yeah. Thanks.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
the war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often, those of us who don't fit into this dumb, stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Gate, criminals and libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. 3 years ago, I came across a goldmine of news clippings detailing a scandal that rocked my small southern hometown. As I flipped through each page, this forgotten story came back to life.
I was told that it was just supposed to be a massage parlor.
The big shot in Davos Barker.
He beats me continuously.
If you print anything that you hear in the grand jury, you will be put in jail.
I never gave any massages.
Listen to Hooker Gay, Criminals and Libertines in the South on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. And so the January 6th House committee hearing,
Coachella
primetime event, was it really postponed due to
that
dude not being able to make it?
No. Technical difficulties. They said technical difficulties.
What?
Yeah. They said they're having
fuck does that mean? Really?
I have no fucking idea. I mean, they're fucking 90 years old, dude. Like, somebody probably misplaced a thumb drive. I'm like, where's that stick with the videos on it? You know? And we're like, fuck. We're fucked. They're the ones that are going to fucking... Oh, fuck. But yeah, was postponed due to technical difficulties. And if you read the fine print on the poster for Coachella, you knew that it was subject to things like that. But they did, I think, as like a consolation prize, release some footage of Representative Loudermilk from the state of Georgia. So I don't know if you remember, right after January 6th, there was a member of Congress who was a, you know, former military that recalled another member of Congress giving tours, but to them looked suspicious because it looked more like recon than it did, hey, and this is where I eat lunch. It was more like,
right.
Yeah, man, like, look over there. Take a picture of this entrance or this tunnel. And that sort of raised some alarm bells. So I believe, let me just make sure, it was Representative Mickey Sherrill. And Loudermilk filed an ethics complaint against this person, against Representative Sherrill, because of this allegation. In 2021, around that time, completely denied giving any fucking tours at all. Never right. gave a tour ever to anybody around then. The fuck are you talking about? Then this spring, he kind of revealed a little more. He's like, okay, fine. I may have given a tour to like a family with like some small babies or something, but that was it. Like, there's really nothing to see. And then he even went on to Laura Ingraham's Racist Shriek show to double down on the fact that he did absolutely nothing. And this is all just a bunch of hokum. And I just want to play you this because things begin to change for Mr. Loudermilk.
Then they say, oh, it was at the Capitol complex. There were hundreds of people in the Capitol complex, the House office buildings. In fact, it was the Democrat leadership ordered the gift shop open on the 5th because there were so many visitors there. So Mickey Sherrill's accusation that there were no tours allowed. Well, there are no tours allowed at the Capitol, but there were plenty of people at the House office buildings because it was just another day. And now, when it comes out, and no mistake about it, the Capitol Police were clear that they are trained in looking for suspicious activity, and the group I had in the House office buildings did nothing suspicious.
I mean, it was a total lie. I'm just going to say, on it. Congressman, it was a lie. It was a smear. They did the same thing to Donald Trump.
Okay, cut to Wednesday when the January 6th...
Real quick, the headline there on the Chiron was, they smeared good men. Is that is that a play on words that I'm not understanding? They, like, a few good men?
No,
that what they were... They smeared good men.
I feel they're completely out of ideas over there because they're like, man, we're going to have to fucking look at video of your ass giving a tour in a second. But, oh, they're just smearing you. I can't believe it. And so... cut to now this fucking footage coming out as the January 6th committee describes it. Quote, surveillance footage shows a tour of approximately 10 individuals led by you to areas in the Rayburn, Longworth, and Cannon House office buildings, as well as the entrances to tunnels leading to the U.S. Capitol. Individuals on the tour photographed and recorded areas of the complex not typically of interest to tourists, including hallways, staircases, and security checkpoints. So now he's out here being like, all right, so what? But they were there for the gift shop. It had nothing to do with any January 6th stuff, just because that guy was wearing a MAGA hat. And then you also found out that one of the people on the tour was live streaming shit or posting shit to Facebook on the 6th talking about, we're coming for you, Nadler, Pelosi. And those coincide with pictures they took in the Capitol. So it's very, it's like one of those things, too, like we're saying. Like that politics isn't like fucking real anymore because this guy is just he's been lying the whole time. He's on another show that's pretending to a certain group of the country that it's news and being like, it's all fake. It's all nonsense. And I even have this letter from the Capitol Police that says they didn't see anything suspicious, which to me, I think is actually the thing that sticks out the most at this point, because he's like, they're trained into identifying things that are suspicious. I was like, it looked like some of them were taking selfies was that suspicious to people who broke into their job?
Right.
So I'm really curious now, you know, they say the next day will focus on Trump and Pence, but I'm like, the more and more we look at it, and as many of us remember watching the events on the 6th, being like, yeah, when's the day about the Capitol Police?
Right.
Like, is that another day, too, where you'll talk about anything that was determined to be untoward or maybe aiding and abetting what was happening? Because it's weird that this letter helps to, quote unquote, vindicate this guy who was giving a Capitol tour. Now, I don't know if it's because their own incompetence and they have to say that just to be like, yeah, we saw that and it was fine. OK, maybe we completely fucked that up. But it's the same thing. I don't know. It reminds me of how like the police in Texas, too, are like, we can't show you guys body cam footage. Or else they're going to know our secrets.
Yeah. I mean, this is being programmed. The whole thing is being programmed by like an ABC News former ABC News president who's like in charge of like the Martin Bashir interview with Michael Jackson. Like he's a lowest common denominator guy. And I think the two decisions that it seems like they've made is one to like the thing that really got people was like Kimberly Guilfoyle getting paid too much for her speech which is like women making money. Like they know Americans don't like that. So like I feel like they're doing all of this with like targeting like things, and then they've decided to ignore the role of the police in this and just be like, well, Americans love police. And in fact, we will put like one woman who was like run over by the rioters like out front and center and like make that a heroic thing, because like I think those are two assumptions they've gone on with. They're just trying to program this as much as possible like a Michael Bay movie.
I have a couple of questions for you guys, is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one, I'm curious what you think of the fact that they're not going to do any criminal anything. And then two, I'm just, so what's your take on the event itself? So just to put my cards on the table, and this might be wrong, but I'm always skeptical about sort of heating up political rhetoric in the society. And as someone who's studied coup attempts and things like that in the past, I mean, obviously, I think what happened was very disturbing, and particularly if you were a congresswoman in the building on the Democratic side, I mean, it could have been very dangerous and incredibly scary. But I've always been skeptical about calling it a coup attempt, because it just seems like it didn't have any of the features of what a coup attempt would need to succeed. And it seems like this might be, and I'd love to hear if you think that I'm wrong, it seems like this might actually like channel energies in a direction that is not particularly helpful for achieving left-wing transformation. It's basically spectacle. Not only spectacle, they're not even going to do criminal charges. So I don't know. Just to lay my cards on the table, I guess I'm a skeptic in that regard. I was just wondering what you guys think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely skeptical. I'm skeptical of any time the American government is in charge of tackling extremism of any kind. So from that aspect, I'm like, this seems like a way to just basically try and push public sentiment in one direction or another. I mean, obviously, if anything's, you know, they're going to they can recommend things to the DOJ, but the DOJ has their own investigation happening, where if anything's going to happen, it's probably out of that investigation rather than this like show and tell of like, remember how bad it was when like they were there? I think with like the coup, I think even with naming a Coachella is very tongue in cheek, right? And I think for Americans, we had never seen anything quite so brazen on TV like that, that it just like, people were like, what the fuck was that? And I think because our like, probably our vernacular, the lexicon that we use in talking about politics is so all over the place that we're not even using the words that we even know to mean anything, because we've talked about like
technical sense.
Yeah, like a democracy, right. Even. We're just like, well, if we really want to pick that apart. But I think for me, you know, as I saw it, was pretty much the audacity of powerful white people being able to say, yeah, there's a way we can just kind of keep, just do as we please. And I think that was that's what I saw. I was like, wow, the fucking law doesn't exist to these people at all. Because like you're saying, it was the sloppiest attempt at overthrowing an election when like drunk Rudy Giuliani is running point. So in that way, we were saved by their ineptitude and their just like weird magical thinking. But yeah, I mean, I guess that isn't a dimension I had really thought about of like what the like rhetorically what that would do, because yeah, I do get the sense, or it's very clear that, you know, conservatives or people on the right want to just as easily categorize any kind of action from protesters fighting against capitalism as like an insert, like using all of these other words to kind of just like nullify the importance or like what people are fighting for sure.
Yeah, or like the emergence of new domestic terrorism laws.
Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely.
That'll be used against the left more 90% right. of the time, you know. So, yeah, it's just an interesting moment because it was obviously so dramatic that it's going to be a central thing. But I'm worried about sort of the channeling of energies into something that's pure spectacle when we should be focusing on, especially now that they said the criminal thing. And I don't think the DOJ is going to do anything because no one wants to start that precedent. I mean, when Biden loses, when the Dems lose in the midterms, he's going to be impeached 3 times. That's what's gonna, you're, that's the new norm. The new norm is now the president's going to be impeached. Right. So I don't think that the DOJ is going to prosecute because none of them want to go to jail. That's why they never prosecuted Bush, anyone in the Bush administration, for violating not only international but domestic laws. So I think it's a very interesting moment, and it's good to be, you know, to be able to talk about it in that sense.
Yeah. And I think it's also important for people to like see how disgusting it is too. Like how you're saying, like, we saw some fucking terrible shit and nothing is going to be fixed. And I think getting people familiar with that pattern is also pretty important, because you will see, hey, are you like trying to protect an unhoused community or pushing back against police violence? They'll fucking shoot you in the eye.
Right.
But if you're there saying MAGA and fucking America first, you're getting selfies.
Right.
You know, and yeah. I think that, that much is clear, I think, to most of our listeners. But yeah, there are many other dimensions to it that because, like you're saying, we have, most people are experiencing a reality where there's no ability to affect change. Then we have these weird moments where people want to put all their eggs in the basket, where it's like, Mueller time!
Exactly. Russiagate, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The fucking Steele dossier.
I do feel myself like pulled in two directions, because I do worry about fascism in this country, and like a belief that like it can get much worse, because
it can get worse.
Yeah. Like it can get worse, and I think it will get, like, that is the path we are on, is it getting way worse, because like I said, there are two paths for America to go forward. I don't think that, like, and it sounds crazy and probably might be a little bit like extreme, but it really feels like the energy has just gone from the like neoliberal, like let Wall Street lead type kind of ideal that was considered mainstream in America for so long. And now, like, you could go left, like democratic socialist, or you could go in the direction of fascism. And the I've been using this metaphor of like having like America having an immune system, and like America being absolutely allergic to anything that is like slightly socialist, and being very welcoming of things that are fascist. And like I feel like, so seeing these things, like seeing like what happened on January 6th, like it's still like, I think it's serious because it's an indicator of where things are headed and how much worse things can get in this country. Like that, I think that's where the seriousness and like my attention to it is coming from. Not necessarily that like they were like right there and could have overthrown it, but just like that this seems to be what the country is more comfortable with than any sort of even like soft socialism.
Absolutely.
In,
yeah.
In this country.
Yeah, that's fair. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's all very, it all comes together, and we just look and we're like, wow. Because also too, you think about all these people now, these MAGA QAnon people who are sending into positions of like Secretary of States or being able to now have like their hands on the votes and stuff. You're like, oh my God. Like
it's wild.
They're really going for it. And yeah, it's odd to see just a lack of urgency about being like, that's on a very basic level, not good to have people who are outwardly being like, I don't believe reality and I will determine who, you know, what votes mean, or I'll have a lot of influence potentially in an electoral decision. And those things, yeah, they all come together. But I think with the reason why America is, I think, is just more open to or just like when you put two things in front of like the American consciousness, it's like, what's the one that's more aggressive and dominates the weak? Yeah, right. Yeah, that's kind of more our vibe since the beginning. And so anything that's like about empathy or being like, no, like we need to take care of each other. Like, what the fuck is that? I never heard of that.
I also think an important thing to think about is like what looks more fun. Because I think generally there's like more despair in American society. Like people just feel totally disconnected from power. They feel totally not in charge of their lives. And I think the big appeal of someone like Trump is that he channeled all of those in a direction that seemed like almost jester-like, you know, like that seemed more fun. And I do think that we on the left need to embrace that element of fun, not in obviously a horrible, racist, disgusting way, like someone like Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or something. Well, Ted Cruz is not fun. He just can't fake it. But I do think like that's an important element of politics that we never talk about. It has to be like exciting. When you go to a protest and you chant, it like feels good. It feels fun. It feels good to be part of something. And I think that we've sort of ceded that territory. And that's not, I don't think that's good for political strategy or particularly winning over people who don't really pay attention to things, but we need to get anything done in this country.
Right. So come to our leftist Coachella. It's going to be a really fun event, y'all. We're going to exchange some radical ideas and march on the Capitol.
Well, Daniel, it's been a real pleasure having you. Where can people find you, follow you, all that good stuff?
Sure. On Twitter, at D. Bessner and American Prestige. Please like, subscribe, review, listen. Thanks, guys. Yeah, thanks so much for having us on.
Is there a tweet or some of the work of social media you've been enjoying?
Oh, yeah. Under the Banner of Heaven. Have you guys been watching that show?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's really good.
I've heard a lot. Yeah, people have been talking about
it. It's really good. I strongly recommend it. It's really interesting, and people should check it out.
I love Andrew Garfield. I liked the book when I read it, and I love any story that takes place in the, you know, Latter-day Saint community. What do they prefer to be called?
LDS.
There's the Latter-day Saints.
LDS, yeah.
Yeah, the LDS. And yeah, this is basically about a radical group. So it's pretty interesting.
Oh, you're talking about the Netflix documentary? I blanked out for a second. Or the book about it?
No, just the fictionalized representation.
The show.
I think it's on Hulu. Are they like FLDS kind of people in this one? Like fundamental?
I don't think they're FLDS, but they're because they talk about like the differences between FLDS, I think, but they're basically a radical breakoff group.
There is so much like LDS stuff going on right now. There's like that Netflix documentary too about that FLDS community.
Woo. Miles, where can people find you? What's a tweet you've been enjoying?
Find me on Twitter and Instagram at Miles of Gray. If you like basketball, check out the latest episode of Miles and Jack Got Mad Boosties, where we distract ourselves with sports. And if you want to hear me distract myself with reality TV, check out 420 Day Fiance, where, you know, we just trying to zone out on something. A tweet I like is from Amy at LOLNUE, tweeted, "Oh, we're in a bear market? Well, I think we're in a platypus store." That's what you sound like. That's you.
All right. Tweet I've been enjoying, No Context Brits, tweeted a picture of a Big Mac that has a label on the side that said 100% British and Irish beef, and they just tweeted the troubles.
That was a good one. I saw that. Oh, actually, at American Prestige, we're doing a long history on the IRA. So this week on Saturday, we're releasing our third episode on the history of the IRA. So if anyone's interested in Irish history, please check that out.
There you go. You can find me on Twitter at Jack_O'Brien. You can find us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com, where we post our episodes and our footnotes, where we link off to the information that we talked about in today's episode, as well as a song that we think you might enjoy. Miles, what song do we think people might enjoy?
This is a group called Polo and Pan, and they are like a Parisian duo, and it's like very cinematic sounding. You know, I like music where like when you listen to it, like it immediately sets off like your visual imagination. And this is a track called Les Jolies Choses. And I'm not a good French speaker, but I'll say it like an American, Les Jolies Choses. Okay. If you wanted to Google that shit, by Polo and Pan. But it just sounds like you're in like some, you know, French new wave film or something, but it just got, I don't know. It's enjoyable. It's enjoyable. So put that in your ears on this wonderful Thursday.
All right. Well, the Daily Zeitgeist is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Yep.
That's going to do it for us this morning. We're back this afternoon to tell you what's trending, and we'll talk to you all then. Bye.
Bye.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade. or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.